This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bulgave, sitting in for Terry Gross. It would be hard to exaggerate the tragic circumstances of Jim Grimsley's life. He grew up in a desperately poor family in the rural South. His father was an alcoholic wife beater. Grimsley and his youngest brother were both hemophiliacs. Jim Grimsley has written a novel based on his troubled childhood. It's called Winter Birds. Grimsley is also a playwright now in residence at the Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta. The novel tells the story of an 8-year-old hemophiliac named Danny and his experiences on a snowy Thanksgiving day when his father brutalizes the family during a drunken rampage. Danny is a dreamy kid who often escapes from the poverty and violence of his life by hiding in his own special place by the river. Here's Jim Grimsley reading from Winter Birds.
You think the pines must like the quiet, the same way God likes quiet in church. So you tiptoe through the underbrush. Under your breath you sing, "Shall we gather at the river?" Breaking off the tip of a branch as you always do when you pass a low tree or bush. The beautiful, beautiful river. Stripping the leaves off the stems, tearing them to pieces, and dropping the pieces to the ground. You love the way the bits of leaves fall, the air under them so solid it knocks them from side to side. But soon you stop your wandering and walk directly to the river, not caring how much noise your feet make in the beds of cold, stiffened leaves. You have a place you always go, a certain clearing beside a train trestle that you found the first day your family moved to this house. You like the place because the branches overhead are thin, and sunlight on a clear day falls through them, making nets of shadow on the ground. Today, same as every other day, something in you lifts as you enter the clearing. You jump over a fallen log, imagining Mama warning you to be careful. Don't fall on something and get yourself hurt. You sing the song louder. Shall we gather at the river? The beautiful, beautiful river. To the nearest tree you say, "Tree, now you better warn me if my papa comes so I have plenty of time to hide." The wind off the cold river cuts through you, and you squeeze your thin coat tight. You gaze at the surface of the river, leaves spinning downstream like music box dolls. Honeysuckle grows thick as a mattress on the bank, and you lie on it looking up at the sky. This is what you came here for, to lie like this, to watch the clouds for a while and then to count. 1, 2, 3, shut things away. Shut away the house and the flat fields. Shut away Mama, Papa, Amy Kay, Alan, Duck, Grove. Shut them away. You are an orphan. You live in these woods away from them all, away from the whole world. Your family is dead. Shut them away. You close your eyes. You have come to the river to dream. A dream whose shadows move against your lids.
Your book tells the story of one especially violent night in a violent family's history. It's Thanksgiving night, and I'm thinking that your own father was an alcoholic and would rampage around the house when he was drunk. You tell a story about one night in your family when your mother called the sheriff in for help. Maybe you could tell us what happened.
Well, the syndrome in where I grew up in a very rural part of North Carolina in a town of about 400 people. There were no major cities around us. And so in terms of law enforcement, you had the sheriff and the deputy sheriff, both of whom were friends of my father's, neither of whom particularly liked being waked up at the hours when my father would generally go on one of these rampages. And neither of whom wanted to take him, you know, the 20 or 30 miles to the jail to cool off. So basically what would happen when we called, we usually didn't call the sheriff because, frankly, he was usually drunker than my father. We would call the deputy, who was a very nice man who had no children of his own and, you know, was real well acquainted with the situation in my household. So he would come over, sit with my dad for a while. The minute the sheriff would come in, my father would become totally calm and sober and benevolent and switch totally from what he'd just been, this violent, drunken thing raging in the house. And the deputy would sit down and they'd talk for a while, and usually the deputy would take him away to a motel room rather than take him to jail. And within a couple of hours, he'd be back at the house doing the same things again.
In one story that you tell, you describe the deputy taking your father away, three blocks away, to spend the night in the motel. And then your mother stayed up, afraid that he would come back. Did he come back?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a true story. He came back that night and set fire to the house with all of us asleep in it. It was he worked in delivery of propane gas and was a electrician, so he knew a lot about houses. He knew how to. He basically caused a fire to start near a propane gas tank at the back of the house, and Mom, who was not asleep, luckily heard the sounds and smelled the smoke as soon as it started to come into the house, and then saw him leaving. So now we were never able to get anybody to believe that he'd actually done that, but we all knew that he'd done it.
Jim Grimsley is my guest. His novel is called Winter Birds. As a child, did you feel guilty because of your hemophilia? That if you and your brother had been born completely healthy, maybe none of this violence would have happened?
No, I don't think we ever felt like that, because the violence was so clearly from my father and from something in him that really didn't have very much to do with us. And frankly, his violence wasn't directed against the children nearly as much as it was my mother. It was His special torture was reserved for her, even if it was about the children. I mean, it was what he wanted always was to have her to blame for his problems, no matter how little the problems had to do with him. I mean, my father lost his arm in a farming accident when I was about 6 months old. My mother was miles away from him at the time, and yet for years and years and years, he accused her of being at fault for him losing his arm. I mean, he needed my mother in some strange, almost spiritual way to be his scapegoat for everything that went wrong in his life. It was, and that we knew, that we understand, because it was so clear. I mean, he was the kind of man who would come home and pick a fight with her for, you know, not drinking out of his tea glass when he wanted her to. I mean, the fights were so absurd that you knew they came from something else. And Mom was very, very clear about explaining this stuff in totally unemotional terms. I mean, she didn't pretend that he loved her and that he was trying his best. She told us what he was actually doing. And that, you know, I guess that was sort of scary at times as a kid, but I think in retrospect it was much better for us all. We understood what we were up against. We didn't blame ourselves for it. We knew we were living with a crazy man.
Did he ever, as the father does in your book, cause an injury that made you bleed?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, it was pretty much like in the book, it was inadvertent. He was very careful not to strike my brother or me, because he knew how much that would cost him in terms of money. He also, like I said, he wasn't someone who beat the kids up. He beat his wife up. And I think that's also a common difference. It's very rarely the children who come in. It's either the children or the wife usually who come in for the abuse, in my experience. But I was afraid of my father, but not afraid that he would hit me, which is curious. But we were, I guess, when you have hemophilia, I mean, we learned to think of ourselves as pretty much untouchable. Nobody ever hit me or my brother. Even in the middle of this violent situation, nobody ever hit either one of us.
I've heard other artists who live with disease describe the way in which the disease inhabits their imagination. And they say that, for instance, a facet of the sickness will call up vivid images that they live with through their mm-hmm. art. How would you describe how your hemophilia informs your imagination and your writing?
Well, there's so many ways. Hemophilia taught me stillness when I was a child, and it was a very important lesson for me to learn. When you're bleeding in a joint, it's very painful to move it at all. And so there were weeks and weeks when I was growing up when I wouldn't be able to walk or to move. And learning how to live with that in a positive way rather than fight it the way my youngest brother did taught me a lot about living in general, that And again, it goes back to that, the lessons that my mother taught me by telling the truth. I mean, what she taught me was that this was a fact. It wouldn't go away no matter how much I wanted it to. And I was willing to hear that lesson and to learn it. And so I began reading books and living in books and figuring out ways to be a boy and to be a kid without having to play baseball and roughhousing and doing things that I simply wasn't able to do. And, you know, right down to the point of not ever going barefoot, which is, you know, in the rural South for a kid from a poor family to wear shoes during the summertime was fairly unheard of, but I, you know, that's something I had to do. I didn't let myself go barefoot outside until I was in my 20s, and those are big things when you're 8 or 9, and people around you don't have to think about them, but you do. But I saw the consequences of that in my own brother's life, in that he didn't do what I did. He didn't accept hemophilia as a condition that he couldn't change. He kept waiting for it to go away. You know, when he would get well from one bleed, he would go out and play with my brother who didn't have hemophilia, and they would roughhouse and do all the things that I didn't let myself do. And as a consequence, he had a lot more problems with his hemophilia than I did.
I think what makes your book so powerful, all stories of domestic abuse leave you with this overwhelming sense that there's no safe haven in mm-hmm. the world. There's no safety at home. And for a child, that's everything. Yeah. But you had the character in your book, and you had hemophilia on top of this, which means, as you say, you can't walk outside without shoes on. You're always looking for a shard of glass. There really yeah. is no safe haven yeah. anywhere.
There's no safety even in your own body, I think. Then I truly had a remarkable family, given what we had to go through. I mean, we were great practical jokers. We told jokes all the time. We have a set of the wickedest senses of humor that I've ever run into in human beings. And I think in a lot of ways, I mean, I hate to sound like a broken record, but my mother was just remarkable. And so we survived. And I think that's, for me, when I read this book and compare it to other novels that are about abuse, is that that's what seems remarkable to me, is that I actually do feel safe thinking about this book. I think Danny is safe in a very peculiar way. He's made safe by his mother and by his own strength. And I think that's very important.
My guest is Jim Grimsley. He's the writer-in-residence at the Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta, and he's just published his first novel. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jim Grimsley is my guest. His novel is called Winter Birds. I get the impression you were very close with your mother.
Yeah,
and
very.
That part of that closeness, and I'm guessing here, involved that you were the one who asked her the hard questions about her past and your family.
Yeah, yeah. There was some way in which my mother and I could talk always that I don't think she shared as much then, especially with my sisters and my brother. She and my sister had a difficult time when my sister was a teenager, I mean, as mothers and daughters do. So at a time when Mom was really finally understanding her need to get away from my father, she was reaching out to talk to me about these problems in a very tender and friendly way. And I think I was, in some ways, I was her first friend at a time in her life when she needed friends very badly.
When you're a friend of your parent, it's hard to also be their child.
Yeah.
Did you always feel that, was that your experience, that you were trying to be the adult, trying to shield your mother?
Not so much that, because my mother was very good at enduring and protecting herself. I mean, well, I guess the true answer to that question is, if I think back to how I felt when I was a teenager, yes, I felt very protective of my mother. I think, again, she was always very clearly the mother. She was always very nurturing, and she took care of me, especially when I was sick, very well. But there was always the sense, and it's sort of hard to talk about this, but I gave up on her being my mother in the recognizable ways because of the violence in the family, and I gave that up fairly early, I think. I think that's one of the reasons I could accept the friendship with my mother. I mean, it was clear that my mother could take care of me to a certain extent, but also that she couldn't really protect me. And so in some ways, I think that led to a very basic distrust that's probably still there. I mean, we have a very close relationship, my mom and I, but it isn't, you know, I do have trouble accepting certain kinds of care from her or from anybody else. I mean, I'm rabidly independent, and I don't want to be under anybody else's thumb, including hers.
It's interesting when you talk about your mother that you say both that she protected you as a child and provided safety, a safe haven for you, but you also say that ultimately there's distrust there and she couldn't protect you.
Yeah.
Is this the ultimate paradox of...
I think so, yeah. I think the truth is that what my mother taught me was that there are limits to what any person can do to protect another person. I mean, you know, you hear these stories about mothers who are prepared to lay down their lives for their children, but, you know, I think there's a certain fallacy. You know, I could not have expected my mother to lay down her life for me in opposition to my father. There were certain kinds of protection that were denied her that she simply wasn't strong enough to provide. And that's what I'm really trying to talk about. We had the kinds of safety and security that my mother was never able to get for herself when she was a child. We had food on the table. We had a place to sleep. We had a warm house. Those are very basic things that she didn't have. But she couldn't, in order to get those things, she had to endure the treatment that my father visited upon her. I mean, that's the best way that I can say it. We were physically safe and physically fed and taken care of because she made this bargain. She made a marriage with this man who beat her up. And even when she knew that's what she had to face by staying with him, she stayed. That was the lesson of my childhood, is that no one, no matter how much they loves you, even if they claim to love you unconditionally, really does. I mean, my mother, as much as she loved me, had to make sure that she survived the night with my father. And if that ended up costing me something in the process, that was really no more than she was already paying herself. So I think that's the answer.
Your father committed suicide after spending some time in mental institutions. And
right.
Your youngest brother, who was a hemophiliac too, also committed suicide. And I realize this is an unfair question. I'm asking you to simplify what must be tremendously complex in your family. But how do you describe the connection, or how do you draw the connection between the two deaths?
My father, for all of his violence and for all of his meanness, was not a bad person. He was not somebody who set out to be the way he was. He wasn't someone who enjoyed it. It tortured him very much. And any time I felt differently, I would just reflect on the fact that he'd lost his arm, that, you know, that for the last 20 years, you know, I never knew him with two arms, so I didn't know what he was like before. Mom did, and she said that there was a drastic change in him when that accident happened. So I guess the way that the deaths are connected for me is that I blame in some ways my brother's death on my father and on the way that my family grew up to a very great degree, much more so than I blame my father for almost anything. Because of all the kids that he had, he was closest to my youngest brother and was far more loving to my youngest brother than he was to any of the rest of us. And I think in some ways that wrecked my brother. I think my brother felt a deep connection with my father in himself and felt as if he shared my father's diseases, his schizophrenia and his alcoholism in particular. And in that sense, I think there was that connection between the two things. And in some ways, the child that my father touched the most deeply was the one that he endangered the most deeply.
So have you ultimately forgiven your father? And was writing this book, was that a kind of absolution for you or a purging? Did it help you forgive
him? Oh, it was a great purging, yeah. It was not therapy. I mean, it was much, much more complicated than that. Because I've, you know, as much as this is my own story, the fact of the other side of it that's mine is the writing side of it. I mean, I have wanted to write fiction, to write, to make words into art for as long as I can remember, so that I was always, that was equally important to me in the writing of Winter Birds as was the telling of this very compelling story. No, I haven't forgiven my father. I don't need to forgive him. I mean, that's the business of whatever higher power there is. I don't love him. I didn't love him when he was alive. I don't feel any need to achieve some kind of peace with him. He did terrible things to me. He did terrible things to my family. And even if he were alive, I don't think I would be able to deal with him because of that. So that's the answer. No, I don't forgive him. What he did was wrong.
Jim Grimsley is writer in residence at Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta. His novel is Winter Birds. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.